It's actually the this is the teaching that Rav Master Gu kind of wrote in the book How to Grow a Lotus Blossom, and as kind of the essence of what she found for herself in having this kind of series of deep experiences that she had when she was actually thought she was dying. She resigned from being in charge of, had been at Shasta Abbey 6 years, resigned as abbot, you know, because she was told she's dying, went down here to basically die, and decided, oh, I'm going to go on a retreat and, you know, just meditate basically till I die, and had a series of visions and teachings that she got, and it became a book, and, you know, and this is the essence of it. And in the book she uses, like, you know, uses kind of very, at the time she actually, it was so personal to her that she used very personal religious terms, and her favorite term in the book was Lord of the House. And she actually switched later to using words like unborn, eternal, less. And she kept changing terms all the time. You know, she never had one, because whatever term she used, she felt like had its problems. And but she was pointing out, but here's something I was just reading in her, again, in the Lotus, How to Grow a Lotus Blossom. When I allow external things to influence me, endless space takes on endless colors and forms that titillate or terrify my senses. When I'm still, these shapes, which are the shapes of fear, and the negative side of desire, have no means of manifesting themselves. Desire and craving are but respectable names for fear. I must remember this. They shall not enslave me again. Nothing is born and nothing dies. We shape our fears from emptiness, and unto emptiness they must return. The only seeming real emptiness is fear. The Lord enfolds emptiness is not empty, nor is it not empty. Within the Lord, all senses form thought. All things cease, and nothing ceases. There's neither old age nor death, and there's no ceasing of old age and death as the world understands them. One undertakes meditation when one is young so as to make sense out of life or to escape death. The Lord promises us small presents so he may give us our true inheritance. Life and death, body and mind fall away, for they no longer apply. A few days ago there was a return of my illness. A month ago it would have mattered. Now it is as it should be. There is no extinction of old age and death. If life comes, there's only life. If death comes, there's only death. All acceptance is the key that unlocks the gateless gate. Within this place, there's no suffering, no coming, no going, no ceasing, no way. There is only endless training, appearing here, disappearing there, going in and out, always becoming Buddha. The wheel turns endlessly. The precepts in the Eightfold Path are as tools used by a carpenter, put away when the building is completed, but never discarded lest they be needed again. And obviously there's a bit of teaching in all of that. And the very first thing in what I passed out, the treasure house that she wrote, the treasure house exists. When the Lord of the house permits me to hold the jewel, I must do it with awe and reverence. I must hold it so each facet is distinct. I should not show the jewel idly to those who are caught in fame and gain, who may consider away its worth, but I must show it anyway. And the treasure house is the fact that what is real is the treasure house. The whole point of training is, can we find what is real? Find the real jewel. And an image that I always like using in Buddhism, there's a jewel. It's like somebody who has the most immeasurably valuable thing that, and he's searching his whole life for this great treasure, and it's right here, and he's looking everywhere for it, and he just has to almost recognize what he already has, clear his eyes so almost he can look in the mirror and see who he really is. And we all have the life of Buddha. We all have this great jewel that frees us from, you know, the world is full of people pursuing their desires. If you have the jewel, it's impossible to have a desire. You have what you need. And that's what we're all looking for. And this treasure house exists. It's why we meditate, why letting go is actually the thing that works. Because letting go allows us to see what we have. Well, if we keep pursuing things, we never see what we have. We keep thinking, yes, but. And it's amazing the but we all have. You know, yes, this is true, but. And, you know, and that's a real teaching. And she uses words like Lord of the House. But it's like I was reading something. It's where Ajahn Chah, you know, kind of said he went to see the person who he viewed as his master, this great monk, Prakam Mun. And Prakam Mun said, practice and listen to the Dharma of the Buddha. Whatever you're doing, wherever you are, the Buddha is always preaching. You know, if you're truly awakened, the Buddha's always giving you teaching. And that sounds, again, very religious if you really think about it, you know. But it's the truth is always there. And being a person, you hear, you know, it's like Reverend Master G like to use the word still small voice, which has been used in Christianity and other traditions. But the fact of the matter is you do it, you're going to experience things somehow. Voices, visions, feelings, somehow. You're going to have to experience something. And being a person, it's personal. Even if you know the person is not the deepest reality, still you have to get it as a, you know what I mean? It's like, it's still Reverend Master Jiyu sitting there in the Berkeley Priory having a vision. And she said when she was having the visions, she knew she was sitting in the Priory. She could see the people around her. You know, she knew what was going on. It's just, she was also having a vision, you know, and there's, you know, and if she had to go to the bathroom, she could go to the bathroom and come back and, you know, have these visions that sometimes would last, you know, for a day, you know, where she was going in and out of some experience. Because you have to experience things somehow. And the Buddha is always preaching. And it's funny, Ajahn Chah, when Prakam Mun said that to Ajahn Chah goes, my head wanted to explode. I could not figure it out. My mind could not grasp it. Like, how could the Buddha always be preaching? You know, and that's, you know, kind of almost a, in Zen, it's like giving you a way, because your mind doesn't grasp the teaching. You know, it's not like these are logical concepts, kind of get a grasp on. Okay, like, if I can picture the Lord of the House, maybe I could picture something, when instead you have to just let go and open and trust that all these people who have experienced it will experience it in their own way, too. You know, just like, you know, and we all are different, so it's not like we all... You know, it's like saying, where is the Buddha? Whatever we do, the same reality is always there. You know, as Reverend Master kind of, you know, put it in that very nice piece. You know, things are always moving. And the next thing she says, nothing matters in this piece of writing. Nothing matters sounds despairing, but nothing matters means in the end, it's all going to wash away. It's all just like a dream. Whether you like it or not, there's nothing you can grasp. You think you're grasping something, but it's going to disappear anyway. Poof. Life, the body, poof. You think it's a tragedy, they lose their body, but it's still going to go like poof. Everything's going to arise and pass, and as she puts it, keep reappearing, arising and passing. But the real reality isn't in all those changes. The movement is part of how we experience things, but the real reality lies in the fact that what is real is not moving, isn't changing. You know, when we let go of the dream, nothing's really happening. Something matters, because that's why we're training, that's why you're making this effort. But you're pointing yourself to the fact that in the end, nothing really matters. And one doesn't stand against the other. Just like there's both activity and stillness. There's both doing and being present. There's just changing things and accepting. Both are true. You can accept what's going on and still be doing, changing it. You know, one doesn't stand against the other. Because you're both willing to accept what's going on and realizing it doesn't matter. Yet, this is what's good to do, so you do it. You know, and that's actually training. Because instead of being bound by your desires, you're trying just to be like a leaf being blown in the wind. And the wind in Buddhism is the wind of the precepts, the wind of what's good to do. It'll blow you in the right direction. And then you just allow yourself to do what's right to do. You know, this now needs cleaning. This now needs help. This now needs to be ignored. This now needs something. And the wind's always blowing you. Instead, we get in the way by being filled with our desires, our needs, our wants. And we create a world out of it. When it's just, you're both moving freely, you know, in a Buddha land, you know, if you look at it properly, and you're letting go of things. You know, so that's why, you know, it used to be the door you entered the Buddha hall at the Abbey. Above the door used to be a window which had something from this, which nothing matters, you know. And it'd be like, well, that doesn't sound. And whatever message you used to say, well, if you take it wrong, it's just despair. But you take it wrong only when you matter. And that's why it's despair. I want to matter. And reality keeps pointing out my utter insignificance. And we keep getting into despair because we actually don't matter. You know, and we keep confronting our insignificance. You know, even when we want to make ourselves significant, you know, it's very hard to maintain. You know, the world keeps pointing out that we're just like a bubble. We're going to just pass away. The memory of us is going to just pass away. The people we have impact upon are all going to be like a dream in a short time. You know, it's like, you know, nothing matters. Mindfulness is all. Again, is a teaching in this. Because mindfulness is how we actually see what's actually going on. It's how we awaken to the truth, is by actually being open. Because what lack of mindfulness is usually getting caught into dreams. We're not being mindful. Usually we're dreaming, is what it usually means. We're caught up in a dream of what we want, a dream of this, a dream of what we have to do tomorrow, a dream of this. And by being lost in it, we're losing sight of what's real. While mindfulness, we're seeing just things as they are. And that actually points out, you know, to the fact that we can then see the treasure wherever we are. And when we're training, even though we don't see the jewel, by seeing with an eye that has faith in the jewel, we're starting to see through the dream. The same way as all of you who are training, okay, you can say, oh, maybe I haven't had any deep experience. But as you train, you're seeing with the eyes of the Dharma more. And you start seeing through the solid reality of your problems, your fears, your dreams, basically, become much more dreamlike. You know, you see the unreality of a lot of things. And you take refuge. This isn't the big picture. You know, and the more you're mindful of that, the more you're actually bringing reality into your life. And that actually is nice because it's liberating. What binds us is our hopes and fears. You know, it's like the Zendo of somebody who had the line from Dante's, you know, abandon all hope, all ye who enter this hall. And they had it over the meditation hall. Because in a way, you want to stop hoping and just be. Stop making it like you're going somewhere, you're doing something. You know, just try to trust the treasure is right there. All you have to do is open up the treasure house. You don't have to be special. You can look at it and think, you know, there's something unique about it. The scriptures must be taken literally, for they were obtained at death's door. And what Ramester Ji is saying in that is, when we read the Buddhist scriptures, it's like later she was actually in having this experience, but I didn't quote, is she then just started to recite the ending of the Litany of the Great Compassionate One, because to her that was like the essence of her experience. And that in Buddhism, the reason we pass along a scripture isn't because somebody told us, wow, this is just what we do. It's being passed along because people after great monks after great monks, the people who really are keeping the tradition alive, are finding this the deepest expression of the truth. And, you know, each generation in a way confirms it and passes it on. And it becomes the deepest expression. And the deepest expression of your truth is at death's door. It's when you give up everything, when you're willing to really look at things in the deepest possible way, which is often, you know, I hate to say it, but the thing that really punctuates the dreams for most of us is dying. You know, it just knocks a loop out of all our plans, agendas, all the rest. And as Ramesh actually taught, and I assume it's true, she said, actually, everybody in a way has a kensho, a spiritual experience upon dying. It's just how do they deal with it on it? Because in a way, you will get a chance to look through things and see a deeper thing. It's even why when they have those nice accounts of people who've had near death, you know, basically have been clinically dead, they often, it's amazing that when they do surveys on them, a lot of them's lives have been transformed. You know, people have done studies of this where they'll say they just completely are living a different life now that they're not when they went through that. And it's because they actually saw it through a lot of the dream, you know, of their life. Anyway, any comments as I'm talking on here?
Can I ask the line in the first paragraph where she says, I should not show this jewel idly. And then the last clause says, but I show it anyway. I'm not sure why she feels she should not.
She shouldn't show that idly to those who are still caught in fame and gain, who may consider a way its worth. But in a way, she can't hide it. What she's saying more or less is people who are going to treat it as nothing, you're actually not doing them a favor any more than... A good example of what you're talking about is at the Abbey, we used to have these enormous open houses where literally 400, sometimes, you know, 400 people would come through on a day, you know, and get a tour of the Abbey. And I remember I used to instruct people, okay, what do you do? You know, people would be arranged a tour, and I would have to say, actually, don't express Don't open your heart too much on these tours. You don't want to express your deep faith or how much it means to you, because people often are going to go like, oh, why are you doing? You know, you'll express something and people are going to treat it like, oh, well, that's really dumb, you know, type of thing. Or like, and you don't, and actually I used to tell people on tours in general, you don't, you know, see what people are interested. You know what I mean? You don't kind of display in a way that jewel to people who are going to treat it like it's nothing, you know, by giving, you know, an expression of how much this means to you and have somebody say, oh, that sounds dumb to me in one way or the other. You can just get it in a look and it hurts. And I just said, keep things, you know, very matter of fact and casual, you know, factual, you know. And then if people are really interested, you know, if somebody asks a sincere question, you give them a sincere answer. And I can gave lots of tours because I probably for a number of years, I'm sure I gave more tours than it was my job, you know. Anybody who showed up at the gate, I had to deal with, so I did endless tours. And, you know, if somebody was, I could tell they were really sincere, I would give them, you know, a really sincere answer. But if they were really just acting out of pure curiosity, mm-hmm. you know, it's like, a good example is, why are you a monk? Mm-hmm. My answer used to be, it's because I thought that's what I needed to do. And people would kind of, I want more than that, but I could see they were just, you know, it's like I couldn't come up with a way to tell somebody why I'm a monk. Okay. You know, it just didn't, you know, they were just curious, and what can I say? I didn't have a form that would just explain it to them, and I would just say it's because it's, you know. So I would, in a way, give a non-answer to it. Well, if somebody actually was talking in a way where I thought they would understand it, I would give a real answer, and I did for a lot. You know, it would vary, but I would try to listen to people. It's the same way as giving teaching or anything else. You give the teaching that's going to help people, and you don't give, you know, just like, you know, there's probably people in the room this isn't the best teaching for, but, you know, when you have a large group, you know, you're all thrown in together, and, you know, if I was talking to individually, I would think, well, probably this may not be the best thing to be using for you. You know, something else might be more helpful. You know, but, you know, most of you, you know, you do it. Never come too close nor put yourself too far away from anything. And that's actually something people don't often understand. It's in the scriptures. Don't put yourself too close or far away. You have to kind of just, in a way, coming too close is grasping, and coming too far away is kind of pushing away. Well, the whole practice in Buddhism is the middle way, where whatever unfolds is okay. You're not grasping it, you're not pushing, you're not trying to make something happen. And for instance, in spiritual life, that's one of the mistakes people make. They'll push incredibly hard, trying to make something happen. And they sometimes, in a way, get hurt, because you can't make something happen. When you try to make something happen, often you get overwhelmed. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like if you were really, for instance, most people have some difficult karma to deal with. If you really had to look at it at all right now, it actually would overwhelm probably you. You know, I'm, you know, serious. You know, if people had to look at all of the stuff they need to do, it would be like, I want to give up. You know, you'll want to throw up your hands and actually, but if you really push hard, you may actually, you know, confront a lot more than you can deal with, you know, just like people. Well, you know, you want to both be willing to be still, but you're not trying to make something happen or see everything or, you know, do everything. You're trying to accept where you are and just just do your best, but don't, you know, you're not trying to do it. You know, in a way, you're both doing something, but you're trying to accept whatever's going on right now, whatever the results are.
Patience, right, Reverend Master? Patience.
Patience is, yeah. That's why patience is actually that which converts karma. You know, we can think of all these other virtues, but patience is probably the central one in training that you need, and compassion, actually. You need both. You both have to be willing to have compassion for your whatever you're going through and patience for whatever you're going through. And just be willing to put up with, you know, I mean, to be honest, to this day, what, most of what I feel like I'm doing in training is putting up with me. You know, after 33 years, I'm still carrying this load that I feel like, God, I have to put up with, you know, with Kinray. And it takes patience, you know. It's, to do it. And, you know, if life comes, there's only life. If death comes, there's only death. I step off into death when my purpose for living ceases. I step off into life when my purpose for living emerges. My purpose for living now is to be a monk, so now's not the time to die. What she's talking about is, obviously we don't control completely. We're not controlling necessarily when we die. But from a Buddhist point of view, there's a purpose for living. You know, there's a deep meaning in how you deal with this karmic body, with these defilements, with these problems. And when you see it, that's the purpose. And if death comes, you know, you have to, this is what comes, you know, just be willing not to cling to either life or death. You know, it's just like, you know, often people do it. It is sufficient for me to just be a monk. And for her, that was, you know, not to try, that was her. From a Buddhist point of view, being a monk meant you're just training. You're not trying to be anything. You know, just be a monk. Just be somebody who, and a monk in Buddhism is embodying, is purpose is the practice. And that's the virtue of being a monk, is like you can't kind of say, well, you're trying to be this or do this. You know, the only purpose in being a monk is, you know, you're in this form to practice. And naturally the practice means you do things like help others and do everything else, but it's all rooted. You know, my purpose is never to, wow, let me help others or do this. My is just really to do what's good right now and not care about, you know, what it is or how it is. Just like I remember, you know, kind of going back to the abbey after I'd come down here, and I make bows to the abbot then, and I kind of stand up, and the Master Echo kind of says, Kinray, you know, because I've been down here for a year or two, he says, is your true home in Berkeley, or is your true home at Shasta? Because I've been a Shasta monk for 18 years. And I said, Reverend, I'm a homeless monk. I have no home. Mm-hmm. I'm just a monk. You know, there. You know, and that's actually one of the original meanings of a monk is, you know, is, you know, that you don't have a home. And you know, and the next line, although being careful of the others' training, I cannot do it for them. For they and I make and carry our own karma. They must find their own purpose for living. And that's, you can't do anyone else's training, whether you like it or not. If somebody has a problem, you can't get in there and solve it for them. We all would like to find a way to do that. You can offer what you can do what you can, whatever right action is, whatever is good, you know, but you actually can't do it for them. You know, it's not, it's everybody. The nice thing in Buddhism is everybody can do just what Shakyamuni Buddha did. But that means we also have to be willing to do what Shakyamuni Buddha did. You know, there's no easy way that Shakyamuni Buddha could bypass doing what he did to realize the truth. We have to be willing in our own way, because we all have different karma and different things. But, you know, just like if somebody's an alcoholic, you can't get them to stop drinking. If somebody thinks something's important, you can't make them say, no, this isn't important. Like when I was young, I used to do things like that. Tell people, why are you doing this?
Some of us still do.
I remember just being, you know, this opinionated being. To be a life monk, I must know the harmony of body and mind. And that's a teaching that Master Jiyu, you know, kind of used a lot. And there's a line in Dogen in which he says, you know, training is simply harmonizing body and mind. And that's actually just bringing peace to everything. You know, peace to our mind, peace to all the aspects of our body, peace to things by finding harmony, not letting an element get out of control. And then we bring peace, because body and mind are one in terms of Buddhism. You know, it's not like there's a mind here and a body there. Your body is an expression of the mind. The mind is part of the body. You know, they're not really different. And you harmonize it by not letting any of the elements get out of control, by taking care of the body, for instance, you know, but also not indulging it. Again, the middle way. The body will not know peace until the mind ceases from evil. And again, to harmonize body and mind. And all you have to do is feel that tension, that strong desire. All evil actually just comes out of strong desire, strong fear. Think of any time you've done anything wrong. You'll find strong desire and strong fear there somewhere. You didn't just say, God, I just want to be bad today. You had something that you really wanted, you know, just like something that you were really scared. I can't even remember even, you know, even kind of watching myself now where am I being completely honest, and I realize I'm just trying to avoid some, I'm kind of shading the truths, you know, to avoid, you know, because it may, you know, in a context, let's say, because I don't want to, you know, accept the karma. And it creates tension in our body. You know, it creates lack of peace. It's like in the Sharangama ceremony, a very famous Buddhist teaching, where they just go for every single problem you could have, whatever it is, peace. By being mindful, I will be cleansed of. You know, they go through everything, and then peace, whatever either the emotional problem is, the physical problem is, the mental problem is, if you're mindful, nothing's going on. You're just caught up in a bad dream. Just like, you know, you're upset what somebody thought of you or what somebody did. You know, it's just like a dream. You're just in a bad dream. By being mindful, you will be cleansed, and you can bring peace to that karma, peace to that feeling, peace to whatever's going on. And you can only do that when the mind ceases from evil. The Lord of the house, which again, you know, kind of annoyed. There were actually people who just found that most upsetting that she used such religious terms when she wrote The Lotus Blossom. But, you know, and as I said, she used other terms later. She stopped using Lord of the House later, but when she reprinted this, she still felt those are the terms that came up when she was having this experience, and this is what it is. And you have to remember that a good point from a Buddhist point of view is deep spiritual understanding by Christians is valid. You know, I can read people from all these other traditions, and when they describe what they have, it's all in harmony with Buddhist teaching. you know, and, you know, so it's how you use the terms and look at it, you know, just like, you know, so like Christian mystics were clearly having the exact same experience as Buddhist monks, you know. It's not like, and it's even why in the first edition of Lotus Blossom she put in both some Taoist writings and some actually writings from the Hasidic Jewish tradition that were very similar to what she experienced, because, you know, it's, you know, it's not, you know, most of these things, you know, there wasn't something unique about, you know, even Shakyamuni Buddha. The uniqueness wasn't that he experienced the truth in a deep way. The great thing the Buddha did is he gave a teaching so others could experience it. You know, that's the value of the Buddha. It wasn't, wow, he's the first person ever to have that. From a Buddhist point of view, lots of people have experiences, but can they find a way to teach it? You know, which is what the great value of the Buddha is he found a way to teach it. Lorda House says, if you wish when I make my choices, the consequences are not his problem or her problem. You know, just like one of those things where people got to this day, you know, in some of our things we use male pronouns, and there are people who, you know, that just irritates the hell out of them. It's like, I think, you want to find liberation, don't let it be blocked by pronouns. You know, it's like, you know, it's like, yes, maybe you could, you know, there may be better ways to express things, but realize it doesn't matter. You know, it's just pronouns, you know, just things, you know. Particularly since, and she always got annoyed if, you know, people got upset. She says, damn it, you know, it's like she's probably the first woman who's a Zen master in modern time. All these things as a woman that she did, and to be kind of have women complaining about her being sexist, she thought, you know, it's like, she just found it completely like, just leave me alone, you know. You know, this is the way I want to use the language, and don't get so caught up in how you do it, you know. It's like, do we have to do, you know, you know, so if I'm a monk, I must unceasingly heed the Lord of the House. When the Lord of the House gives you his teaching, listen attentively and respectfully and quickly, loudly, reverently, and obediently say yes. And actually, in a way, you can view all of training as trying to be still enough to hear what's really needed. And it always won't be, you know, as deeply spiritual as she could hear it at these points. But at points it can be. But that's the whole point of training. Can we hear what's really good? And we can hear, remember, all of liberation comes from realizing what's real isn't the self. There's a much bigger, boundless reality that we're part of, and we can actually hear and experience it and see something by letting go of the self. We can act from a place that's boundless, and it gives us teachings. You know, we'll see what is good in a way that we won't see what is right. And to be willing to ask is central in Buddhist life. You know, be willing to get the self out of the way and ask, what is good to do? You know, what do I need? What is going, you know? And to be willing to ask and not put the self in charge where it assumes it knows, it sees, it, everything is based by realizing there's a deeper place I can come from. And do that. You know, and it's, you know, and we're, as I say, and one of the things I always found helpful about Rav Master Jiyu is her deep faith was probably like the strongest thing, is what helps when somebody actually has deep certainty and faith, it actually helps greatly because it becomes almost real. You could feel it when you were around her. And when something would come up, you would just see, you know, that she's acting and this is very real and very powerful and very true, you know, because it's being expressed in ways that, you know, makes a reality of it. And then, in a way, she's helping you see with her eyes, which is an image they always like you. Actually, it's like I always like my... They use it a lot in Zen, but then I remember somebody kind of... D.T. Suzuki kind of was reading Meister Eckhart, and he said, man sees God with the same eye that God sees man. If you follow what, you know, there's just the eye that sees, and God and you have the exact same eye, you know, and it's very Zen because they have the exact same thing pretty much in throughout Buddhist tradition, you know, and why Meister Eckhart always sounds so Buddhist, but he's a medieval Christian mystic, but you read him and you think, wow, that's all Buddhism. It's, I can understand why the Inquisition gave him a hard time. Because he did sound very, you know, very kind of not being restrained by most of the Christian forms. You know, and it's part of it. You know, and it's... You know, but it's important to kind of trust that, you know, as they'll say in Buddhism, whether you're sitting, lying down, shopping, being alone, being with others, right before you is the life of Buddha. The real form is there. Be still, as, you know, Prakamun said, everything is giving us the Dharma. You know, you can, if you're really here, you know, the Dharma is always there, you know. It's like, you know, almost like that thing they found in modern science, the background sound of the Big Bang. I was like that thing that, you know, a while back, you know, they could tune into, must you know what I'm talking about, they tune into that tone, and they realize that tone was the Big Bang, and you can actually hear it, and it fills the whole universe, and you can hear the Big Bang. It's always going on. You know, most, it's a sound that's always there. You know. And the nice thing is, before the Big Bang, the Buddha was already there. Bangs come and go.
I quote you on that.
You know, from a Buddhist point of view, that's such a Big Bang. Universes arise and disappear all the time in Buddhism. You know, world systems arise and pass. You know, these things are, you know, it's like if you sit still, the same realities there won't be affected by, you know, what's going on, you know, whether we're around or not. You know, there's other realms from a Buddhist point of view. The nice thing about science is you often think science, knows everything, but, you know, you read science and you realize they don't, you know, most of it is, they don't even understand most of it. My favorite one is reading somebody on quantum physics who very nicely said, if quantum physics makes sense to you, it just means you don't understand it. If you understand it, it doesn't make sense. You know, you don't understand it. You just know this is how this works, that they know, but it doesn't make sense. You don't understand what's going on or how it works. You don't have a picture in your mind of the principles. It's even why Einstein hated it, because he didn't like, you know, he denied quantum physics because it didn't make sense. You know, and he thought You know, you always follow the principle everything should make sense, and quantum physics doesn't make sense. But it works. So they know it's true, just they can't figure out how it works. Which, you know, just kind of... So I assume they know what they're talking about. The one who gave that quote was a Nobel, you know, was a legendary scientist, so he hopefully understood quantum physics. Anyway, I'll stop because on my watch it's already 12:30.
That's right.